and also the Portland Planning Bureau Director, Gil Kelly, for their contributions to and from their respective staff. So with that, I'll turn it over to Commissioner Fish.
Well, thank you, Mayor, and thank you for your leadership on this issue and for inviting me to work with you on this important project. Our objective today is to have the council accept two reports. The first is a response to an audit which was conducted with respect to residential tax abatement programs, and the second is the first annual report on those programs. Both documents were prepared by the Bureau of Planning and the Portland Development Commission with assistance from the Bureau of Housing and Community Development. This continues my efforts, Mayor, and your efforts to respond to the Council's desire to better understand the scope, breadth, and cost of the city's housing programs and to exercise an appropriate level of oversight on how they are administered. Today, we will be returning to the subject of limited-term property tax abatements. Over the last 2 weeks, each of my colleagues should have received both documents. The first is the response to the city audit on residential abatement programs. The response deals with technical issues raised by the auditor. The auditor also noted that several of the abatement programs would benefit from a clarification of their goals. This briefing this morning should provide council with necessary background information that will be helpful when we take up goal clarification later this winter in the context of the Portland plan. The second report is the first annual report, including information on performance in relation to program goals and objectives, as well as the outcomes of compliance monitoring. Multnomah County, as the mayor alluded, has asked for an annual report with similar content, as well as some additional analysis that relates to the city's programs to the county's core mission of serving low-income citizens. I will be sending the report to the county next week and plan to meet with Chair Wheeler to discuss it or to brief the county commission if they so choose. Mayor, I've invited the auditor to lead off this morning to comment on the audit response. And then I have asked Barbara Sack of the Bureau of Planning and Keith Witkowski of PDC to provide a brief presentation on the highlights of the annual report. Mr. Auditor.
Good morning, Mayor, members of Council. Gary Blackmer, Portland City Auditor. With each of our audits, we really work hard to build a strong working relationship with the agency we're auditing and build a persuasive case for improvement. And we're very pleased to see these kinds of responses come from our recommendations. I think the staff of the Bureau of Planning and the staff of the Portland Development Commission need to be commended for their efforts to improve the accountability over these programs. And we recognize that all the challenges in those recommendations can't be addressed immediately, but we see that they're on the right path to address all those that take a little more time. And I want to extend my appreciation to Commissioner Fish for his leadership and bringing this together as quickly as he has. And to that degree, you know, we think that this is an important message to the community that the city holds itself accountable to make sure that it's doing its very best to accomplish what it can with the dollars. So I appreciate these efforts, and on behalf of my staff, we thank you for your attention to this.
Thanks very much. So now we'll invite up Barbara Sack and Keith Witkowski to give us a briefing on the annual report.
As you know, both planning and PDC.
Could you state your name for the record, please?
I'm Barbara Sack from the Bureau of Planning.
Keith Witkowski, Portland Development Commission.
Yes. Both PDC and planning have responded to the audit's recommendation, of which there are five. One of the city audit's recommendations is the production of an annual report. So we're going to go over the highlights. Keith will address the results of monitoring and compliance, and I will give some policy context and program outcomes. If you have any suggestions for additional content that you would like to see in this report or any changes to it, let us know. This is our first annual report, and we plan to do these every year, so you know, give us some feedback on it. Okay. The first recommendation of the city audit calls for the city council to clarify goals and objectives of the tax exemption programs and the assignment of responsibility for oversight, evaluation, and reporting. We just want to let you know that there will be work sessions on city housing programs this fall and early next winter that will assist the council with the clarification of the goals and objectives of the programs. They are listed here. I'm not going to go into detail. And as Commissioner Fish said, the Portland plan should give us a context for making larger changes to the programs. You know, if the council decides they want these programs to really go in a different direction, that would be a good place to discuss that, because we'll have more information on the city housing market when we undertake that plan. Here is a summary of the goals of the tax exemption programs. In Appendix 1, we go into detail on specific goals and goals of area plans that the programs carry out. I'd like to point out that while the city programs carry out important housing objectives, particularly related to housing production and housing affordability and preserving the housing stock, the programs that have boundaries are mapped as part of our city planning and our area and transportation plans. So they are also tied to some transportation planning goals and growth management goals. Okay. I'm just going to briefly go over some of the major program outcomes. One of the major outcomes of the programs, of course, is housing production. There's three programs that provide an incentive for new housing production in areas of the city where we want to see new development. And these are the single-family program and the two multifamily programs. The single-family program supports neighborhood revitalization through new development and affordable home ownership opportunities. The home buyer opportunity areas are mapped for low and moderate income areas of north, northeast, and southeast Portland. The multifamily programs provide an incentive for high-density housing in areas that have good transit service and the programs promote transit-oriented development. And these are also areas where the city and metro wants to accommodate new population growth. We want to accommodate new population growth in these areas so that people moving here aren't going to create unnecessary traffic congestion if we have housing right on the light rail line or in the central city, which is a place that a lot of people work, then that will help us with that goal. So as you can see, there's about 2,000 units that have a single-family tax exemption, and there's over 3,000 units that have an exemption through the new multiple-unit housing program and the TOD program, which are our two multifamily programs. Next, the programs support the provision of an adequate supply of low-income housing. Our nonprofit program is the largest program, and there's almost 8,000 units assisted by this program. The housing in this program is mostly existing housing, although nonprofits do build new housing and apply for this exemption. This is also the program that results in the greatest foregone revenue. The other programs, the multifamily programs, also have rental units, and overall, all the city's tax exemption programs consist of 82% rental housing. 79% of this 82% of the rental units are affordable to low-income households because there are projects under the new multiple unit housing and TOD programs that actually have rent-restricted units, usually tied to their financing. In the programs that allow home ownership, there's an income guideline for all the programs that a household be at or below the median family income for a family of four, which is currently $67,500. So there's a cap on buyer incomes in the programs that allow home ownership. You also see the foregone revenue figures here. These are total foregone revenues figures for it's the foregone revenue to all taxing jurisdictions. The city of Portland foregone revenue is about a third of this, or about $5.6 million.
Is that an annual amount?
That's for 07-08, yeah. And that's for all the jurisdictions. I have to say, though, that there's a lot of projects that are in urban renewal areas. So if a new project is built after an urban renewal area is created, then the foregone revenue actually would have gone to pay off the urban renewal bonds. It wouldn't have gone to the taxing jurisdiction. So the effect on the taxing jurisdiction.
That depends on the type of urban renewal area, isn't it?
Exactly.
Right, right, right.
Does it apply in all urban renewal areas?
Correct.
Right.
Do you want me to speak to that? Or
sure.
I mean, basically, we'll just
in
look
fact,
at...
In fact, I think it'd be beneficial for people to understand the nuanced difference between the different...
Sure. So let's look at the Oregon Convention Center Urban Renewal Area, which stretches, it's northeast Portland, for people that aren't aware of it, stretches along MLK versus a district such as Lentz, outer southeast. In the Oregon Convention Center Urban Renewal Area, based on decisions made in the mid-90s, PDC receives a fixed amount of money that we use for investment, and all the growth in property taxes above that fixed amount go to other jurisdictions.
Right.
So in those cases, the revenue that is foregone from these tax abatements directly affects the city, the county, and education. In a place like Lentz, where it was created after some state regulations, PDC receives all of the money. So in those cases, and there's a number of units in those areas, it affects PDC, and it's still dollar for dollar. I mean, it still affects our ability to do projects in Lentz if we're abating properties within that area, which obviously bring benefit. But
great. Thanks, Keith.
I was done with my portion of the presentation, so.
Okay.
So I was going to ask, and I don't know, Barbara, if this is the right time to do it. Were you going to continue on with a presentation, Keith?
I was going to continue on with the compliance monitoring information.
Why don't you go ahead and let me ask after that.
Okay. So, you know, as Barbara talked about how while these programs have much broader, more comprehensive intent behind them related to growth in the central city and transportation and all those factors, you know, in discussions with Commissioner Fish and others, one of the most important things for City Council in order to have a good conversation on housing policy and how you want to use tax abatements in the future is you feeling comfortable that compliance monitoring is occurring and it's being done well. So what I'm going to speak to in these next couple of slides is kind of how we've been safeguarding the public resources and the results in this annual report of abatements that were active in 07-08. So again, we broke it down by looking at, first of all, the ownership units. So these are the single-family homes as well as units that might be in transit-oriented or multifamily developments that are ownership. There were 698 units that were audited in 07-08. We found of those 47 that needed to be terminated. And you know, they were terminated for reasons such as, you know, maybe it was an owner occupancy. What we did is we looked at there's a number of things we looked at, and it's in the annual report, so I'm not going to walk through every single step. But some of the highlights was trying to find out whether or not if the unit's owner-occupied or whether they're renting it out. Because if you got the abatement a couple years ago and you're renting it out, you're not eligible to continue to have it. So we looked at tax returns. We looked at the property tax bill and said, hey, is the property tax bill going to the address or not, as some of the clues to help us determine whether or not an abatement was, you know, being used the right way or not. So from that work, there were 47 terminations that occurred, and council acted on those just last month, I believe, or maybe it was earlier this month, to officially terminate them. That resulted in $83,000 in property taxes being returned collectively across all the jurisdictions. And, well, if you want the breakdown, it's on the slide in terms of from the single-family homes, it was about $68,000 that resulted in the abatements being terminated. And in the multi-unit and transit-oriented, those about $15,000, $15,500. The other piece we looked at were the rental units. And first of all, I want to acknowledge that a couple weeks ago during the Shaver Green decision, Commissioner Leonard asked about whether there was language in the code that required developer financial reporting, whether that was clearly specified in PDC agreements or not. And so we've been taking the proactive approach. I looked into it, and I've been guaranteed that in both the regulatory agreements for new projects as well as for any tax abatement extensions, that code language is in those agreements, so the developer knows that. And we can talk much more about this in January as well.
But you've been doing that right along since we adopted that in 04?
Well, from my understanding, is it's going into the templates. It's been going in this year.
Okay.
So I think it's something new based on some of the things you had talked about. Not new from 2 weeks ago, but it's being put in there.
Sure. Good.
So with the rental units, there were about 1,350 active units in 08-09. And what's happens with this is different, because if there aren't necessarily terminations, if through working with the property manager, they have to get forms from the tenants to have them prove their income. So again, we'll look at things like a W-2. We'll look at things like, are they on assistance? And if so, can you prove it? We'll look at, you know, income tax returns or pay stubs or those kinds of things that they have to prove up their income eligible. If somebody is not income eligible, then it's not as if the terminating the abatement occurs. What happens is, you know, basically they have to find somebody that is income eligible. And so what you're seeing in this, the results of this, is not so much taxes returned, but it's looking at whether or not any of these units expired, and that's typically what happens. And in this case, there were 249 expirations in 2008. It was spread across multiple projects. I've got all the background if you want to see what those projects were. But what we've got here and what we identified then is there's 410 remaining abatements and in transit-oriented, and 940 remaining abatements in the multifamily. And on this slide, what we tried to show is how those are broken out over income, so you have a good idea of that. And let's actually, the next slide talks about next steps, so I don't want to go there until we answer some questions that
Number expired in 07-08 means the abatement ended. Is that
correct?
Correct.
Okay. Correct.
Keith, I have a question. You're in response to both the audit and to direction from this council, PDC and planning are doing a much more robust job of monitoring compliance with the terms of these abatement programs. But is this, in your judgment, something that should continue to be done by PDC and planning, or should this be contracted out? And I'm asking for your view after going through this cycle.
I think that there's elements that probably could be contracted out. I'd want to talk to our staff specifically about what they were. But I think, you know, across the board, in whatever the situation, people tend to be more comfortable if it's done by an outside accounting firm or whatever it might be. And I think there's an opportunity, as long as the resources are there to pay for it, to farm some of this work out.
Well, just to follow up on that, that really ties into the question I was going to ask. It's my understanding that currently those that seek abatements make application, and then they provide you with data that speaks to the public benefits in the three categories you've outlined. And then they provide you with financial data showing why the abatement is necessary. The kind of nuanced difference that I think might be better building on the success of now having the annual financial statements come in, and possibly even joining up with Commissioner Fish's observation that maybe contracting out to monitor compliance, something that else that might make sense would be, and I'm interested in your thoughts about this, is having the applicant come to you and that we have a pre-designated list of folks that are in the private sector that then do that analysis. And the only difference is they would have to use somebody that we designated to do that analysis, and they couldn't use their own hired guns, if you will. And the reason I think that it makes sense to me, and I'm curious what your reaction is I think that allowing a developer to construct the argument as to how he or she meets the three categories of public benefits, and then allowing them to construct the argument about the affordability allows them to construct those arguments, versus having a pre-designated group of contractors that work for us that know that their loyalty is to us and not the developer that hired them. I think we might get a more objective analysis of the application. Any thoughts on that?
I'd need to. I know that, and I don't know if I'm speaking in parallel in terms of what you talked about, but I know like with PDC, we have underwriters that look, that give a bunch of financial rigor to determining whether or not there's a need there, a financial need.
But don't they do that based on what's supplied by the developer?
Shelley Hack, Portland Development Commission. Part of the analysis is a review of the information that's provided by the developer, as well as an evaluation of the breadth of material that's provided to PDC by other developers for similar projects over time. So that, yes, we are evaluating information provided by the developer, but there's an industry kind of evaluation that's done as well.
And help me understand this, do they hire somebody or employ somebody that packages that information for you before you get it to analyze it?
Sometimes the developer does. Sometimes the developer has the technical skill on staff to produce the financial performance for them. Sometimes they have a consultant that they hire that helps them takes them through the entire development process and does that performa analysis for them.
So I guess that's the position I'm talking about. Is there some opportunity for us to have the list of those kinds of consultants that they would be required to use to provide us that data?
There are a list of consultants that could perform that similar type of analysis, yes.
So you're talking, okay, I think what you're saying is the developer was to come to us and say, I want to build project A,
mm-hmm.
and we said, well, we have a list of pre-approved consultants here, and we'll team you up with one of them, and they'll work with you to determine what the financial need is, if any, and whether a tax abatement is needed.
Right.
Okay.
I think it's, Commissioner Leonard, I think it's an interesting idea, and it's exactly what this discussion is meant to provoke, because the report is neutral information. What you're reacting to is ways in which we can make sure that the implementation of this, or the continuing implementation of council will, is done at a higher level. And
it definitely is a more, it's on the list of things that are important to be done. It isn't the top of the list. You've accomplished that, I think, with embracing the annual financial data. So I guess all I'm proposing would just tighten that up just a little bit more. The idea being that the as the auditor said, clarify the goals and objectives of the housing tax abatement programs, and you list what those are. For me, it has always been causing something to happen that otherwise would not happen. That's the trigger as to whether or not you use an abatement. And then, of course, for what purpose is it then if you make something happen otherwise wouldn't happen, for what purpose are you doing that? And I guess all I'm trying to do is get to this place that when we give abatements, there's truly a targeted policy that we want to provide the base abatement for, and second, that we've determined independent of the developer that it's absolutely necessary to make it happen or it otherwise would not happen.
Can I suggest on that point that since what we're going to have in forthcoming council sessions is a chance to take a look at whether, in fact, existing programs are meeting our goals, mm-hmm. and whether there are any changes that the council wants to make to existing programs, either by contracting or expanding, that as part of that, we also ask for a presentation as a future action item on specifically what you've mentioned, on the sort of due diligence that we go through, and whether an idea like you've suggested with a panel of neutrals that would you'd be required to use so the information we get is not packaged but right. is consistent. I think it's a great idea, and I would ask that be part of a presentation
okay.
to us.
That sounds good.
The other thing I want to mention before we get into the next steps, which I neglected to, is that Commissioner Adams also talked about during the Shaver Green presentation identifying property tax abatements as a line item expense, and we've gone back and talked to our budget folks. So that it'll be, if there's abatements going on in Lentz, it'll be a line item just like a line item for the Lentz Town Center project. And so you can see the cost for the following year, for the current year. And so you can see it demonstrated in that way. Did you want to discuss next steps or do you want me
go
to?
Go ahead.
Okay, so the next steps on this, as Commissioner Fish talked about earlier, will be transmitting the annual report to Multnomah County, and there'll be conversations with either the chair or the entire board on the results of that. There'll be the short-term discussion of tax abatements in early 2009 in terms of what kind of things we might want to adjust along the lines of what was just discussed. And then there'll be the longer term, more contemplative exercise of how do we want to use tax abatements in the future as part of the Portland plan and kind of what we want to see the city become in the long term. And then there's the ongoing conversations right now of the economic stimulus package consideration and what kinds of decisions need to be made in conjunction with release of that in the middle of November versus what can wait for these other two events. And that is it.
Questions from the commissioners? Is anyone signed up to testify on this matter?
No one signed up.
Is anyone here who wishes to testify to this specific issue? This is a motion both accepting the response to the 2008 city audit and accepting the 2007-08 annual report. I have a motion to accept and a second.
So moved.
Second. Please call the vote.
Fish.
Well, first, I want to thank my colleagues for framing this discussion with very clear signals to various agencies that they want a more robust level of oversight over our tax abatement programs and more accountability. And as we all know, through enhanced accountability, we establish greater trust with the public that we're asking to support any or all of these programs. I also want to thank Barbara and Keith. Barbara, this is your second shift. You were here last week on Shaver Green. And I thank you for the clarity of your presentation and all your hard work. I want to thank Shelley and for her work, and Beth Kay and other team members at BHCD. I believe we have something solid to build on. The hard work is ahead when this council looks at whether we want to continue or modify any of these tax abatement programs. And that, I think, no doubt will provoke a rich and lively discussion. But you've given us the tools to make a more informed judgment as we go forward. And I thank you for that, and I'm pleased to vote aye.
Leonard.
Well, as I said last week, I just really appreciate Commissioner Fish's work on this. It is the most transparent and, I think, open I have sensed this whole subject matter of abatements being since I've arrived on the council. And it feels like we're going in the right direction. So I appreciate it. Aye.
Saltzman.
Well, I want to thank Mayor Potter, Commissioner Fish, PDC for and planning for their good work on this. This really is, I think, the first time I've seen things in such succinct form, and to be able to actually know that it's 16.7 million in foregone taxes this year for our combined abatements is, I think, a fact I've always grasped for in the past, and often get asked that at business luncheons and things like that, and now I have that answer, and I think we have the tools in place to really, make sure that these abatements are going exactly for the purposes that we intend them to do, and so the monitoring through the auditor's office as well are great things to have in place, and so this is good, and I look forward to looking further at these policies and considering them explicitly as line items in our future budgeting. Aye.
Potter.
I want to thank Commissioner Fish, and I echo Commissioner Leonard's comments in terms of both the processes and transparency as well. So thank you very much to the PDC and the planning staff. I think this is an excellent job. I appreciate the auditor. I'm not sure he's still here, but I do appreciate his initiation of what became a framework for the resolution. And I think what this really does, too, is it also helps with our other political partners who also give up some of the taxes on these abatements and exemptions. And so I think it'll add credibility to this program as well. So I think this is an excellent way to start. Thank you. I vote aye.
So, Mayor Potter, I just have a point here. I had a prearranged event with the new ownership of the Portland Winterhawks at 11. And I noticed we have four emergency ordinances. I realize that if I leave, they'll have to be brought back next week. Does that create a particular problem if we put them over to second reading, or can we hurry through them?
Are you going to be here tomorrow afternoon?
Mm-hmm.
Then we were going to hear these today. Three of them are personnel issues that arose out of the implementation of the EBS system. So we're going to hear these today and do all of that preliminary work and then vote on tomorrow at 2.
Okay.
So that it really won't slow any of these things down, because otherwise the EBS system cannot be implemented.
Sure.
Until these.
No, I understand the purpose.
What time do you need to be out of here?
Well, 7 minutes ago.
So, Danielle, would you be available tomorrow if we put this over and did it as an emergency matter tomorrow? How much time do you think you need to do the Section 108 presentation?
I would say 5 minutes.
Well, we'd be happy to put
Great.
It over tomorrow.
I appreciate it. Thanks.
So let's go ahead and hear then the next three items together, items 1471, 1470, 71, and 72.
1470, authorize a letter of agreement with Portland Firefighters Association authorizing application of the payroll smoothing process currently authorized for 42.08-hour per week unit members to 42-hour per week unit members assigned to the fire inspector series. 1471, authorize a letter of agreement with the City of Portland Professional Employees Association authorizing the city to determine part-time employees' vacation accrual rate based on length of employment in calendar years. And 1472, authorize a letter of agreement with AsME Local 189, District Council of Trade Unions, to pay parking enforcement officers a 5% premium for actual hours worked on special projects that are duties outside of the job description.
Commissioner, did you have something you
Mayor,
wanted
may
to
add? Just to understand our schedule, and because I have some teammates here, can I get clarification on how the mayor would like to handle 1474, which is a presentation on an emergency ordinance to get authority to seek a loan from HUD? Would you prefer that we do the presentation tomorrow and act on it tomorrow as an emergency ordinance?
Well, we're going to be hearing all of these today, and they're all four emergency ordinances, but voting on tomorrow.
Okay.
And what that does is save time at the front end. So
okay.
All we do is come in and vote tomorrow.
So Danielle, stick around. We'll have you still on the schedule.
Good.
Thank you, Mayor.
Okay. So would you handle those first three, please?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor and commissioners. My name is Steve Herron, Labor Relations Manager for the City of Portland. And Mr. Mayor, as you noted, all three of these relate to EBSP blueprinting. In relation to the first, there is a contractually approved process for payroll smoothing for firefighters that are on shift. They can have anywhere from 8 to 10 shifts during the course of a month, which means that the number of shifts in a pay period varies, which means that their pay for any given pay period can vacillate actually quite dramatically. So there's a contract provision that allows the pay amount to be annualized and then divided equally so that there's an equalized pay. That doesn't include overtime and so forth, but for base pay. That practice apparently was being applied to 42-hour unit members assigned to the fire inspection series. The Bureau, BHR, and the union all have an interest in seeing that recognized contractually. And so we're proposing a revision of the contract that extends the payroll smoothing, not just to the 52.08 shift employees, but also to the 42-hour fire inspector series.
Mayor, I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yes.
Right now you don't have a quorum. You only have two of you. And so I think Carla's going to go run and get Commissioner Fish back in here. So we should probably hold off until we have a third, please.
Okay. Yeah, but I will be asking a question, or you can respond to it. In terms of, I assume that all these have been negotiated with the appropriate unions. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. I just asked the question, Commissioner, in terms of these three items we're hearing all have been negotiated with the union. So this is the final result of that negotiation.
Thank you, Mayor.
The second of the three is that currently part-time employees' vacation accrual rate, the contracts provide that vacation accrual rate changes over a period of time. So as a person has longevity with the city, the rate at which they accrue vacation increases over time. For part-time employees, the amount of vacation accrued is already prorated. On top of that, the provision has been that the movement from step to step at the accrual rate would also be prorated. So for example, somebody working half-time would have to work 10 years before they had the equivalent number of hours of employment to move to the five-year, move from the five to the next, five-year to the next step on accrual rate. For a couple of reasons, one being uniformity of the EBSP, or excuse me, of the SAP blueprinting and configuration, and also as a matter of equity, frankly. Our conclusion was the proration of the benefit amount was an adequate balancing of the benefit for those individuals that are part-time, and that, frankly, making somebody be here for 10 or 20 years before they move to the next accrual rate was an unnecessary penalization of part-time status. So the proposal here is that part-time employees would continue to accrue a prorated vacation amount, but that they would move through the accrual rate steps based on calendar years of service. The third item is that there are various premiums that are memorialized. PDOT has been recognizing a premium for parking enforcement officers engaged in, quote, special projects. That premium either was at one point adopted by some form of agreement that is no longer binding or wasn't fully adopted. And in any event, after our review of the premium and assessment of its use, we concluded that it's a valid and reasonable use of the public resource. And so we are encouraging the council to adopt the letter of agreement that would authorize payment of a special project premium of 5% for assignment to special projects for individuals within the parking enforcement.
Can you give me an example of a special project?
You bet. Development of the handheld citation writer, training and transition for implementation to the handheld citation writer, creation and installation of barcodes on signage, compilation of statistics from the service request program, compiling statistics for spreadsheets. There are certain things that don't fall directly within the job duties as described in the classification of a parking enforcement officer. However, based on the specialized knowledge that, that the parking enforcement officer has, those folks are frankly most efficient people for us to utilize in accomplishing that particular work. And that's the context in which we
use that. I just want to be clear. When you say 5% premium, you're saying 5 cents on the dollar.
Correct. That is correct.
5 cents? It says 5%. That's different than 5 cents.
5% for a dollar.
I mean,
5% being 5 cents on the dollar.
I was just triggering Mayor off the fact that we think a premium time is typically being double time, time and a half, time and a quarter. 5% is a new one for me, and that's essentially a nickel on each dollar of wages.
That is correct. Correct. It's not, for example, at an overtime rate or some other rate that we see from time to time in contracts or in wage and hour statutes. Do you have any questions about either any of the three?
Thank you. Was there anyone signed up to testify on this?
I did not have sign-up sheets.
Is there anyone sitting in this room who wishes to testify to any of these specific issues? 1470, 71, and 72 will be taken up tomorrow afternoon at 2 p.m. to vote. Thank you.
Thank you.
Please read item 1473.
Revised pay in park and non-pay private parking facilities regulations.
The second reading, call the vote.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Potter?
Aye. Please read item 1474.
Assigned City Section 108 revolving loan pool application to the Department of Housing and Urban Development to create the Portland Housing Preservation Fund.
Commissioner Fish.
Thank you, Mayor. Mayor Potter and Commissioner Saltzman, as you know, we have some ambitious affordable housing goals at the City of Portland. And our strategies include developing new units, and preserving the existing stock of affordable units. As your new housing commissioner, I'm focused on preservation in part because currently in Portland there are 11 affordable buildings with over 700 units of housing that house largely an older and frail population attached to federal rent subsidies that are at risk of losing their affordability. Think Clay Towers when these issues come up. Clay Towers was a classic example, and there was a community rescue plan that preserved those units. When these subsidies expire, and 11 properties are at risk between now and 2013, it could mean a significant loss of federal resources to our community. This is why the city and our partners at PDC are committed to preserving all 11 of these buildings between now and 2013. Now, to preserve these buildings, we will need to invest some local public resources into the various projects. And, of course, this is a challenge today because of shrinking budgets at the federal level, increased need here in Portland, and the daunting financial forecasts. To meet our goals, I have charged BHCD staff with exploring innovative and cost-effective financing strategies that will assist us in preserving all 11 buildings while meeting our city's preservation policy goals. The ordinance today responds to this challenge. Staff at the Bureau of Housing and Community Development are proposing that we implement a revolving loan fund using a Department of Housing and Urban Development program called the Section 108 Guaranteed Loan Program. A yes vote will authorize our application to HUD to implement a revolving loan pool addressing preservation financing. But let me be clear. It'll authorize us to submit the application, but it does not authorize us to spend the money for any particular purpose at this point. Danielle Ledesma, who is one of our key staff people at BHCD, is here to present this program, how we intend to operationalize the fund, and to give some further details about our application. Danielle?
Morning. I'm Danielle Ledesma. I'm with the Bureau of Housing and Community Development. And like Commissioner Fish said, we were charged with coming up with either new resources or trying to find creative ways to use our existing resources to address the challenge that he mentioned before. And we were charged to do this because an analysis of the potential development pipeline of new projects, as well as looking at the preservation needs, showed us that our needs far exceeded what we had available in terms of our traditional financing that we provide for projects. Luckily, we didn't have to look very far. With the National Development Council, who's our consultant and works with us regularly, we looked to HUD's Section 108 Guaranteed Loan Program. The City of Portland has used this program before. We've used it for demolition and infrastructure costs at New Columbia. We've also used it for economic development projects in Northeast Portland along Alberta and Mississippi Streets. So what I'd like to do today is tell you a little bit more about how the program works, tell you how we'd like to operationalize it here at the city, and why I think this would be a good thing. The City of Portland, as you know, is a participating jurisdiction with HUD, which means that we receive the federal entitlement money, including Community Development Block Grant, or CDBG, which we use for housing resources. The Section 108 Guaranteed Loan Program allows participating jurisdictions to leverage their annual entitlement and to borrow up to five times an entitlement amount to carry out eligible activities. The intent of this program is to bring Wall Street capital to Main Street. And what HUD would like to do is to incentivize private market investment and local projects to go ahead and increase their impact. And the way that HUD is able to do this is that they provide a federal guarantee on each loan that's made by the jurisdiction. And it's a way that they can attract private market investment. And what that does is that it guarantees repayment because it's guaranteed by the federal government, but also a return that's comparable with Treasury rates. The financing details, what we found is that this is a really low-risk, low-cost source of funds that we can use pretty nimbly. Like I said before, we can borrow up to five times our entitlement amount, which allows us to really significantly leverage our financing. We also, the guarantee right now is one of the safest deals around because there is this federal guarantee. It isn't a city obligation. By implementing this program, what we're really putting on the line is the community development block grant, the program on a national level. It's not a city general obligation. Repayment is required. It's amortizing debt. It carries a 20-year term. And interest rates, there's an initial interest rate that's based on LIBOR, the London Interbank Offering. And those rates right now for about 6 months is about 3.5%. And then we, at the time when we decide is feasible and works with our financing and the underwriting of each project, we can then commit to a fixed rate, which is based on Treasury rates, which right now for 20 years is about 4.5%. The other thing that's really exciting about this program is that we're able to flexibly underwrite project by project. We don't have to set a strict underwriting guideline for all of our projects, but we can really look project by project at their financing needs and then create financing that responds to those needs in a way that will promote sustainability in the long term and also our own repayment requirements. This is a non-competitive application. So when we submit our application, what we're really doing is just asking for authorization from HUD. The way that we intend to structure it here in Portland is that we'd like to create a pool rather than to ask HUD loan by loan for authorization. And what this does is streamlines our process and responds to the needs of our nonprofit housing providers so that they don't have to wait 3 to 6 months for each deal. It gives us local autonomy and an ability to structure our funds the way that we'd like to. So the way that we'd like to implement this is we want to create the Portland Housing Preservation Fund. We intend to apply for $15 million of Section 108 guaranteed loan funds. We will use this on eligible projects. They do have to be CDBG eligible, which includes acquisition, rehabilitation, refinance, and reprogramming, which lends itself towards preservation, the activities that we need to carry out in order to meet our preservation goals. We estimate that we can assist anywhere between 10 and 20 projects. Right now, our sort of forecast of the projects that will most likely be prioritized and funded by this fund show that folks need anywhere between $500,000 to a little over $1 million. So we'll be able to really stretch our resources in the short term to meet our preservation goals and also be able to respond to the needs of our community. There is a repayment. There's many different scenarios where we can provide repayment. One of the ways that we've modeled out repayment is that for projects that cannot carry debt, which is most of the federally expiring preservation units, we can use part of our CDBG entitlement to repay that. And the way that we've structured it is that we won't carry debt larger than 30 to 50% of our current line item allocated for rental development. So we're watching project by project to make sure that we don't reach a point of indebtedness that would put our rental development program at risk. Essentially, the budget impact is that by allocating about $300,000 to $500,000 per year to repay the loan payment for this program, we potentially lose the ability to do one project, but we are gaining anywhere between 10 and 15 time-sensitive projects that we need to be able to finance in order to meet our preservation goals. I see the advantages as that this is a really low-cost source of financing. The rates are we've done some research and looked at different foundations that provide program-related investment. We found that the interest rates are lower than those. Also, right now, a bond financing would be difficult given the financial markets. And so this is a really low cost. We also like that it's flexible and it's easy to administer. We have an agreement with the National Development Council to provide underwriting and to help us administer the fund, and it's done at a very good rate. We've negotiated with them to do that. I think that the fund is innovative and creative simply because it's really not sexy, but it's stable. It is low cost, and we can meet our immediate needs now in a time when affordable housing deals are really are at jeopardy because of the inability to get credit, the devaluation of the tax credit markets. This is really one of the safest tools that we can use, and it's timely. So we're really excited about this. We intend to approve our application. HUD needs a city ordinance which gives your approval for the application, but it's not a general obligation by the city. You're just saying that this is something that you are aware of and that we will implement, but the city is not on the hook to provide any financing. So take any questions.
I had two, Danielle. One is, what is our odds of having it, of HUD approving this? And then secondly, if approved, will it in any way affect any of the other HUD programs that we are recipients of?
The approval is what we've been told is 100% sure. It's really more of a process than a sort of competitive application. It really is just sort of every jurisdiction has the authority to use the program and to borrow against their CDBG. They're just making sure that we, you know, filled out all the correct paperwork. In terms of jeopardizing our other programs, what the program so, for example, the City of Portland, let's say the City of Portland receives $1 million of CDBG every year. That's our annual entitlement. This program is not borrowing that $1 million. It's in addition to, we have the authority to borrow up to 5 times that $1 million. So that $1 million remains untouched. Locally, we've decided that to support projects that cannot carry debt, that we will allocate a portion, not to exceed 20% to 30% of our line item for rental development to repayment, but that won't impact any of our other federal entitlement dollars.
Other questions?
Just a comment before we take this further. This, I think, also, to my colleagues, fits nicely within the discussions we've been having about economic stimulus. And the mayor-elect has asked that we be very creative about looking for new opportunities to leverage financing, to be able to move quickly, to put, you know, to jumpstart projects, as well as to meet our other goals, as I mentioned earlier, to preserve housing. To me, this is one of the most innovative ideas that we've been presented with in a long time. It gives us access to some capital that can backfill projects otherwise wouldn't happen. Allows us to work with an array of partners on some high priority items. And as Danielle, I think, in her superb presentation noted, it doesn't put the general fund or the city on the hook for anything. This is simply a way of capitalizing on our normal stream of CDBG money. And through a unique financing deal with the federal government, allows us to access incredibly low rates of interest on the money. So
that was a very good presentation, Danielle. Very clear, very thoughtful. I think we all understood it.
I should say, Mayor, that I'll embarrass Danielle, but she is really one of the big stars at the Bureau of Housing and Community Development and in our broader community, very active with Just Portland and other organizations, and we're very proud of the work that she does for the city.
Thank you, Danielle, and it's good to see you blushing.
I will say, though, that I was admonished the other day at a community meeting. Someone noted that she had given a great presentation, but said that after reading her name, they said that the commissioner kept mispronouncing her name. Her name obviously was Daniel, not Danielle. I noted that I was taking my cue from Danielle, that it may be spelled Daniel, but I was quite sure her name was Danielle. But she's taken the lead, Mayor, for the city on the Jerome Sears site. Mm-hmm. And is working with the Neighborhood Association to create a kind of community oversight process that I don't think we've seen in these affordable housing projects before, working closely with the Neighborhood Association chair and others, and being a liaison between my office, BHCD, the Department of Defense, and the affected community. So we're very proud of our work in that area, too.
Thank you, Danielle. Thanks. Is anyone signed up to testify on this?
No one signed up.
Is anyone here who wishes to testify to this specific issue? This, along with the other three emergency votes, will be placed on the 2 p.m. calendar tomorrow as a vote only.
All right.
Recessed until 2 p.m. tomorrow.